KQED.
This is primary election coverage from the California Report. Good evening, I'm Scott Schaefer. When the polls close in 1 hour, we'll see how voters are feeling about their government and their elected officials.
We're getting near record lows in the job performance rating of the legislature. Large majority saying the state is moving in the wrong direction. So this is not a good time, in my opinion, to be running for re-election.
This election is the first test of redistricting by a citizens commission and our new nonpartisan top two primary system. How will it affect incumbents?
I almost feel unrepresented in many ways as far as the political party is concerned. I almost feel like the party, I haven't left my party. My party's left me.
It's election night coverage from the California Report, and we'll get started right after this. This is primary election coverage from the California Report. Good evening, everyone. I'm Scott Schaefer. And in this final hour before the polls close, we're examining what's at stake on today's ballot. Statewide issues ranging from term limits to a tobacco tax increase, as well as dozens of contests for Congress and the state legislature. Joining me here in the studio is Corey Cook, assistant professor of politics at the University of San Francisco, where he directs the Leo T. McCarthy Center. Good to see you, Corey Cook.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Well, first of all, Corey, a big picture question. What's at stake in this election?
Well, I think you hit it on the outset. I think the state ballot measures are interesting. There are a variety of local ballot measures. There's a big pension reform measure, for example, in San Jose. There are a lot of tax measures that are on the ballot locally that will get us a sense of public mood. I think the candidate races as a political scientist are fascinating. I'm not sure there's much at stake in terms of the final outcome because a lot of these will actually be decided in November. But I think it'll be interesting to see the intra-party dynamic. So the Democrats versus Democrats, Republicans versus Republicans will be very interesting.
And that's a big change from the past in and of itself because, the lines as they were drawn by the legislature in the past were basically very safe for incumbents and their party. And so whoever won the primary in June or whenever it was, well, it was pretty much assured victory in November. It's not that way this time at all.
No, and there are two things that have changed. One is that the district lines have changed. They've been redrawn by a Citizens Commission, and the expectation is that they'll be somewhat more competitive, although it's still very difficult to draw real competitive districts in California just given the nature of the population and the demographic differences between the coast and inland and urban and rural and things like that. But the second thing is this top two primary, as you mentioned, and I think that's it'll be interesting to see again how this plays out in terms of November, where you have these elections that will undoubtedly in the Bay Area, for example, pit Democrats against Democrats in November and other regions of the state, Republicans against Republicans. And so in many ways, the primary is going to be a rehearsal for the general election rather than something that decides the November election.
And later in this hour, we'll be going around to some of those congressional districts where we have some hot contests going on. We've got reporters out around the state, and we'll be checking in with them shortly. But you mentioned the Redistricting Commission. That's a good cue to bring in one of the members of that commission. Maria Blanco joins us now from Los Angeles. She did serve on that 14-member Citizens Redistricting Commission that drew the boundaries for today's congressional and legislative races. And Maria Blanco, how do you feel about the work you did and how it's played out so far in this primary?
Well, I feel very good about the work we did. I think we had a very strong commission that took a completely fresh look at California. In some ways, we were redistricting about 20 years' worth because the last couple of redistrictings had really been, incumbent, protection districts. So I feel we did a good job of starting from scratch and really trying to make some sense of the population differences in California, drawing districts that made geographic sense as well as, keeping certain communities together. I think it'll be hard to really know, as your other guest said, coming together with the top two primary, it'll be a little hard to dissect what the impact solely of the new districts is in terms of, how much it's realigned.
Well, one of the impacts we do know, which is that we've got, in some cases, some incumbents running against each other, and we'll be talking more about that in a moment, but that's happening, for example, down in Southern California, where you've got Brad Sherman against Howard Berman, two longtime Democratic Congress members. What do you make of that? Obviously, you didn't set out to do that, but when you've got redrawn districts, that's going to happen, and you've got also Congress members moving altogether out of where they were into another district they've never represented.
Yes.
What impact do you think that has on the political system?
Well, just I think to talk specifically about the Berman-Sherman race and those districts, that was a problematic district from the previous redistricting.
Problematic how?
In the sense that Congressman Berman's district, when his brother, who did the line drawing, drew those districts, they very specifically set out to carve to basically pick voters for the congressman, and the district really did not make sense. It was, you know, if you ever looked at it on a map, it was one district sort of horseshoed over another, and the fact that they're both now in the same district is a result of the fact that the district as we drew it really divides the valley evenly east-west, and you know, the majority of the district is Congressman Sherman's old district.
Yeah.
So it really that is not so much just the a coincidence that they ended up in the same district. It had to do with how the old districts were drawn to begin with, that you know, the location, their residence, and how the districts had been drawn to accommodate that.
Yeah. And
really
let me...
was distorted.
Yeah, and I want to bring in Rafe Sonnenschein. He is executive director of the Pat Brown Institute of Public Affairs at California State University in Los Angeles, where that race, that Berman-Sherman race, the so-called Battle of the Ermines, is playing out in the San Fernando Valley. Good to have you with us, Rafe Sonnenschein.
It's good to have you. I never heard the one, the Battle of the Ermines. That's a good one.
Oh, okay. Well, I assure you I did not make it up. I wonder how you think this top two primary, in addition to the redistricting, so now you do have these two incumbents, Howard Berman, Brad Sherman. How has the top two primary played out in that district, do you think?
Well, I think it's just going to wear everybody out because we know they're going to face each other again in November. So essentially what they're doing today is trying to tell donors that they are pretty likely to win. If one of them falls way behind the other, that becomes self-fulfilling because they're both raising money like crazy to try to take each other on. The Republicans aren't really a big force, but they'll turn into a big force in November because both of them will have to get a lot of Republican votes to win. So it actually brings the Republicans alive a little bit in a Democratic district, that they're kind of potentially the balance of power in there. And maybe that's what the designers of this had in mind. You certainly see other districts with two Republicans at the end where Democratic voters may be able to make the difference.
And that notion that down the road they're both going to need more moderate voters, including, you know, more conservative Republicans as well, perhaps. How did that change, do you think, the way they've campaigned in this first round?
Well, Berman especially has been trying to get endorsements from Republicans, but I think that he has a bit of a pitfall in his campaign because he's been running as the candidate of the Democratic Party. He has every single practically elected official in the Democratic Party, and Sherman's out there by himself. But Sherman could turn around in November and say, I'm a little bit more independent. Look, they haven't all endorsed me, so if you want someone to be a pain in the neck to the big party people, I'm your guy. So that what's so weird about the top two is that it completely scrambles the way people run for office in California. The redistricting shakes up the incumbents for one cycle very, very, very badly. But the top two shakes up everybody's way of thinking how to run for office.
Is that a bad thing?
Well, I'm always happy to see things shaken up. You know, I mean, politics just gets too kind of stuck in routines. But it's going to lead to some interesting stuff that people haven't really thought about. It's the end of third parties in California.
Exactly, because in November there will be no Greens running or any independents for any of these seats, right?
It's a trade. You trade third parties for the possibility of declined estate people running for office and winning seats. And that may actually be a good trade. It's a wild trade. There are people abandoning their party identification and running as independents who may finish second and then run as either the center-right or the center-left candidate and actually pull it off. I mean, this really strikes me as the world as designed by Arnold Schwarzenegger.
What do you mean?
Well, if you look at the redistricting commission, the top two, all of these things were meant to create more moderate candidates who are not tied to the two parties. Now, poor Arnold didn't do much on the budget, but his legacy may end up being some quirky rules that allow quirky people to get in who don't necessarily have to follow the pledges of either party.
Hmm. Well, that's a good time.
That may be starting to happen.
Yeah, and that's a good time perhaps to bring in Dan Schnur, director of the Jess Unruh Institute of Politics at the University of Southern California. Dan Schnur, do you see this as sort of Arnold Schwarzenegger's last laugh in a way? I don't mean that to be too glib, but this is what he wanted. And Abel Maldonado as well, the lieutenant governor who's now running for Congress down on the Central Coast, they were hoping that the top two would moderate who runs and who wins elective office, especially in the state legislature. Do you see that perhaps playing out?
Well, and that may end up being the case. There's no question that was Governor Schwarzenegger's and Abel Maldonado's goal to elect more moderates of both parties. But I suspect as we've watched the primaries under these new rules for the first time, whether or not we see more moderates elected is still an open question, Scott. I think what's more likely is that because we've seen an increase in the number of competitive elections, we're going to see a much larger number of responsive candidates elected to office.
Responsive how?
Well, under the old rules, in order to get elected, all a candidate really had to do was appeal to the base, ideological base of his or her own party. A Republican talking only to the most conservative members of the electorate, a Democrat talking only to the most liberal voters in his or her district. And what we're seeing here already, and Howard Berman's example in the San Fernando Valley is one that you guys have just been talking about, is the top two primary forces candidates to talk to a much broader range of voters in their community, not just talking to the most liberal of Democrats, the most conservative of Republicans, but talking to more centrist members of both parties and to independents and declining states as well. And I suspect that voters, the candidates running in more competitive elections, talking and listening to a wider range of voters, end up being more responsive elected officials once they do take office in Washington or Sacramento.
Let's go now to one of the districts where this kind of top two primary has played out in some interesting ways. The second congressional district up in starting all the way from up at the Oregon border down to Marin. I'm talking about the second district that was represented mostly by Lynn Woolsey, a Democrat who has retired. And the district that goes all the way up to Eureka and even further north includes Petaluma, Novato, and San Rafael. And KQED's Mina Kim is there tonight at one of the campaign headquarters. And, Mina, this is widely regarded as one of the most liberal congressional districts in California. President Obama won 71% back in 2008. How have the candidates in this race positioned themselves?
Right, Scott. If you're anti-war here and pro-marijuana, you probably reflect the views of a lot of the voters. But the challenge for the candidates here has been to differentiate what kind of liberal they are. So there's been 12 people who are vying for Woolsey's seat, and there's about four or so that analysts say are for the top contenders. Jared Huffman is one of them, and he's run on his environmental track record, and also as a lawmaker, his ability to work across party lines. He's the assemblyman from San Rafael. Then there's the Marin County Supervisor, Susan Adams, who has tried to talk about her local experience and also her experience as a nurse that could potentially heal the Washington Rift. You've also got another one who leans left, Norman Solomon, who has described himself as the Occupy candidate, and he differentiates himself by saying that he hasn't taken corporate money. And then the last is Stacey Lawson, a tech entrepreneur, who says she has the business chops, actually, to help the economy. So they've sort of tried to get at different parts of that liberal electorate.
Yeah. Now, Jared Huffman, who is the state assemblyman from Marin, is widely regarded to be the man to beat in this race. But how has the race for number two played out? Has it gotten, has it gotten kind of nasty?
Right. Because it is such a liberal district, there is a very strong chance that two Democrats will face off in November. And so what we've seen is a really competitive and really, like you said, kind of a nasty race. Both Susan Adams and Norman Solomon have really gone after Stacey Lawson. They've basically given Jared Huffman a free pass and gone after Lawson on not having voted much in past elections. They have tried to link her with the former GOP gubernatorial candidate Meg Whitman for voting only about 4 out of the 12 last elections. And they've called her a carpetbagger for not having lived here for very long and a corporate profiteer. So what you're seeing is Democrats really beating each other up for a second place spot.
No, I was going to say, is there any chance with all these Democrats running and beating each other up that a Republican could sneak in to the runoff?
you know, there is an outside chance that a Republican could take it. The only problem is the Republican who has the GOP's, the state GOP support is Dan Roberts, and he's actually contending with another Republican in the race who could potentially split votes. And so while that that is an outside possibility, that is quite a challenge to have another Republican in the race when you want to have as many Republican votes as possible and even try to get some Democrats to go your way.
All right. Mina Kim, KQED's reporter tonight up in Marin County, where the second congressional district race is going to be interesting. We'll be going back to her later in the evening. Mina, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Scott.
Corey Cook, that district, that seat, is one of several here in the Bay Area that are quite competitive. Another interesting one is over in the East Bay, where you've got Pete Stark, who has been a very rated, in some cases, the most liberal member of the entire Congress. He's been there, I think, since 1973, and he's facing a big challenge. He hasn't really ever had to run a real race, at least in a long, long time.
It's been a long time.
Tell us about that race and how this new top two primary system and the redistricting is playing out there.
Well, I think certainly redistricting makes a huge difference in terms of that district. But I think there are two sort of sets of dynamics you're seeing in the top two primary. The one is the sort of safe party district where you have this slugfest within the party. And the other is this phenomena where you have essentially a three-person race. And it sorts out as a Democrat or Republican and some version of a moderate, either moderate Democrat, moderate Republican, declined a state voter or some version of that. And I think when this was packaged to voters, it was largely talked about in terms of that being the dynamic, that in that type of general election, that person stood no chance. But in this environment, that there would actually be a push towards the moderate candidate of either party. Either moderate Republicans would cross over in the primary or vice versa. And that would actually propel somebody to then run in a general election where they've already won that other party support. And I think that's the way it was talked about by Schwarzenegger. That's certainly, I think, what Abel Maldonado had in mind when he was talking about statewide candidacies. I think the question that I wonder about is whether it plays out that way in these low-intensity races where voters don't have a lot of information about the candidates themselves and actually use a lot of the party labels and name recognition and other types of cues. I can see that working that way very much so in a gubernatorial race, for example, where someone like Schwarzenegger might have crossover appeal. But in a lot of these local races, a lot of what you're seeing is a lot of name calling, a lot of personal conflict. As Dan Schneur said, there's a lot more talking, but that means a lot more spending, frankly.
Yeah. And Ray Sunshine, one of the things that has happened this year as a result of especially redistricting is you've had some retirements of some longtime members of Congress, at least seven that I can think of. Wally Herger, a Republican up near Reading, David Dreyer in the San Fernando Valley, L.A. area, Jerry Lewis from San Bernardino, Elton Gallegly, and then Democrats, Lynn Woolsey, we just mentioned, up in Marin and Sonoma, along with Dennis Cardoza and Bob Filner, who's running for mayor down in San Diego. So that is going to – what impact is that going to have when the new class comes in and all these people with all this experience are gone from the California delegation? And that doesn't even include either, you know, Sherman or Berman won't be around either, and others where there's two Democrats or two Republicans facing off against each other. What impact does that have?
Well, you know, for California, I think it only matters if you're in the majority. So as long as the Republicans are in the majority in D.C., I'm not sure that the experience of Democrats in Congress is all that – relevant.
Because they won't be party chairs or committee
chairs?
Well,
because, I mean, really, the House is run like a machine, whichever party runs it. It's not like the Senate, with, you know, the institution of blowhards. I mean, it's basically an army. And if the Democrats pick up 25 seats, though, then you start to wonder if you lose, say, someone like Howard Berman out of the Democratic delegation, that becomes a bigger deal. I think what's interesting is all these open seats, all the redistricting, and all the new people coming in are now coming in under the new rules. So maybe they would be better at sort of navigating this. I would say this thing, even in what might seem low visibility races, if you go down to Ventura County in the 26th district, we've got the race where this thing is really going to be tested. You've got a strong Democrat, a strong Republican, and a Republican who has turned into an independent for the purposes of this race, Linda Parks. And she really has a chance to finish second. And it's, you know, Democrats thought of this as a pickup opportunity, but they're terrified that she'll finish second. I'm not sure Republicans aren't terrified that she would go and then beat Mr. Strickland, the Republican, in the runoff. But this is the perfect example of what we're talking about.
Unintended consequences, yeah.
And if she pulls this off, then you're really looking at kind of the refurbishing of the Republican Party against its will.
Yeah.
And that's, again, what Arnold Schwarzenegger did. He wrote an op-ed several weeks ago down here in Los Angeles about what the Republican Party needs to do. It sort of sunk like a stone, but I thought it was awfully interesting.
Quick comment. Go ahead. Yeah, I just want to finish up because I want to get to one of our reporters in the field.
Oh, sure, of course. But basically, this system is meant to help giving the no-tax pledge and move a bit to the center against the will of the Republican Party. And that's always been what Arnold was all about.
Yeah. Did you want to jump in, Corey?
I just think that's a great point. I think that's exactly there. There are, I think, five or six candidates in the state who have not taken the no tax pledge. I think it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. And if this does, in fact, these candidates end up coming in second in the November general election, that is going to change the Republican Party in California.
Dan Schneider, I just want to get your thoughts about what Rafe Sonnenschein said, that, you know, that seniority doesn't really matter. Except to the party running the House. I mean, do you think that there is any loss for California with people like Jerry Lewis and others who've been around for so long going away, all of them at once?
I think Rafe makes the right point. If you're in the majority, losing that seniority is a very important loss. In the minority, being the ranking minority member of a congressional committee is just a more frustrating position to have than being a backbencher. But if I can, Scott, real quickly talk to the point that Rafe and Corey both made about the impact of decline to state candidates. And I think they're exactly right, but I think they're half right. On one hand, there's no question the presence of decline to state candidates running for office is going to put pressure on the Republican Party to move away from its ideological base. But I suspect the same thing will happen for Democrats as well. Remember last year when Jerry Brown proposed a tax increase in pension reform? The Republicans refused to listen to him on taxes. The Democrats refused to listen to him on pensions. So just while some Republicans may be able to pry themselves loose of the type of anti-tax pledge that Corey and Rafe were talking about, It also creates the opportunity to elect some Democrats who might not be quite as beholden to the most powerful interests in that party.
Yeah, so it goes both ways. Let me bring in Sasha Coker right now. She's our Central Bureau Chief in Fresno tonight, where we have at least a couple of congressional races that are playing out, including the 10th congressional district, which includes Tracy, Turlock, and Modesto. You've got Jeff Denham, the incumbent Republican, against a couple of others, Jose Hernandez, a former astronaut running as a Democrat, and Chad Condit running as an independent. Sasha, give us a sense of this district. It's considered, I think, one of the real swing districts in California. Why is that?
That's right, Scott. You've got an example of three strong candidates running. They're pretty fascinating candidates, and they're running in a district that has been redrawn to have a slight Democratic edge, but voters here are still pretty moderate. And so people think that Jeff Denham is pretty much a shoo-in because voters are likely to vote for somebody that's got strong support for farm interests. The real question is whether Democrat Jose Hernandez, who, as you mentioned, you know, spent his childhood as a migrant farm worker and then ended up as a space shuttle astronaut, whether he's going to make it in as the Democratic candidate. He's got a story that's got strong appeal for the large Latino population in this district. He's got the backing of the National Democratic Party that wants to see this seat turn blue. And then you've got this kind of wild card, this independent Chad Condit, son of former Modesto area Congressman Gary Condit, who, as we all know, kind of lost his footing after the scandal involving Chandra Levy. But the younger Condit, is now running this shoestring campaign. He's got his family out there hitting the pavement, walking precincts. And analysts I've talked to say, that grassroots approach and the name recognition in the district could really give him a shot.
Well, so does the name Condit, is that a plus, do you think, at this point, so many years after the Chandra Levy murder?
Well, in the district, voters have a very different perspective than perhaps people do nationally on the Chandra Levy scandal. The elder Condit is still beloved in the district. Many voters I talked to said, this guy stuck with us as his constituents. He wasn't willing to be swayed by either party. And so the younger Condit, now running as an independent, his father was a Democrat, is really trying to pick up on that thread. And analysts I've talked to say that, this was once Condit country and the name recognition in the district could really give him a shot. So this is an example where we may possibly have an independent versus a Republican and no Democrat on the November ballot. And that would be a first.
Sasha Coker, our Central Valley Bureau Chief for the California Report. Report tonight, reporting from the Valley about some of the hot congressional races there. I'm Scott Schaefer, and you're listening to primary night coverage from the California Report. Sasha, looking at the 21st Congressional District, a little further south there, Kern County, southern Fresno County, the towns of Hanford and Delano, among others. There's an open seat there, but Jim Costa, who represented much of that area, has moved, I guess. Tell us about that seat and why it's, what makes it interesting.
Well, you know, as you say, it was Costa's seat. It was historically considered a Democratic district. But, you know, now the lines have been redrawn a little bit, and it includes more conservative parts of Kern County and less of more liberal South Fresno. So it's a seat that the GOP is hoping to pick up. It's also very interesting because it's a 70% Latino district, although historically there's been very low Latino voter turnout. And again, you've got a very interesting cast of characters vying for the seat. There are two Democrats, one Republican. One of the Democrats is Blong Zhang, former Fresno City Councilman. He would be the first Hmong American congressman if he were to win. And he's got the strong backing, again, of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. He's also garnered some Latino support because of his own immigrant story. And then the other Democrat is John Hernandez, who's CEO of the Central California Hispanic Chamber of Commerce here. He's a staunch backer of the high-speed rail project, which has really proved to be a dividing line between the parties here. And then you've got the lone Republican in the race, State Assemblyman David Valadeo. He's a dairy farmer. He's staunchly opposed to the high-speed rail. And his current assembly district lines kind of parallel the new congressional district, so he's sort of like an incumbent. But really, I think... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, how has that issue of the high-speed rail, how has that played out there? I mean, I know I realize it's a dividing line, but is it a 50-50 dividing line or not?
You know, in rural areas, in agricultural districts, and again, this district includes some more urban areas that see the high-speed rail as a job creator, and then you've got the rural areas where farmers are really opposed to this project going through their farmland. There's been a real rift between them and the high-speed rail authority in terms of the planning process, and so I do think high-speed rail, it could be a linchpin that some of these races are going to turn on. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, Blong Zhang, the other Democrat, is also supportive of high-speed rail, although his Democratic competitor, John Hernandez, has really made it part of his platform. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
All right. Sasha Coca, the California Report, Central Valley Bureau Chief. Thanks so much. We'll be checking in with you later in the evening.
Thanks, Scott.
Let me bring back Maria Blanco now from the Citizens Commission, the Redistricting Commission. And Maria, give us a sense of how the commission thought about what's called communities of interest. And I'm thinking in particular Latino voters. We just heard that there are a lot of Latino voters in those districts in the Central Valley. Oftentimes they don't turn out in very large numbers. But how did that fit into your calculation as you drew those lines?
Well, the issue of communities of interest and the issue of Latinos were somewhat separate in the sense that for some of the districts that ended up having large and, in fact, majority of citizens, voters that were Latinos, those decisions about the districts were really dictated by the Voting Rights Act. So they were about communities of interest, but we had the criteria that we had to follow highlighted the Voting Rights Act and maximizing, opportunity districts for minorities.
What's a good district you think where that could play out?
Oh, you can see that. I think an interesting district there is actually Congressman Berman's old district is now a majority opportunity Latino district. And in fact, that's whoever goes on to the general will probably be Latino. And it's very likely that you'll have a Latino congressman for the first time in that district. You see that in San Diego. Former Congressman Filner's district is now a majority Latino district. It wasn't before. And in fact, there's speculation that that's why he decided to run for mayor, because he had had a very close primary with a Latino
the last
earlier.
Time around. Yeah.
Yeah. So those are slightly different discussions than, say, for example, in this district we're discussing now, District 21, you did the communities of interest there were more around looking at agriculture, looking at sometimes mountain, you know, foothill districts, water districts. And sometimes if you're looking at an agricultural district, you're also picking up Latino voters. But it was not necessarily looking at Latinos as a community of interest.
That's Maria Blanco from the Citizens Commission that redrew these lines for this 2010 census. And for the next 10 or I guess 8 years now, we'll be using those lines. I want to bring in, we do have a couple of statewide ballot measures we haven't talked about yet, Props 28 and 29. I want to bring in Bob Stern. He's past president of the Center for Governmental Studies based in Los Angeles. Bob Stern, good to have you with us.
Thanks, Scott. Nice to be with you.
Let's begin with that Prop 28, which would tweak term limits in California. The voters seem to like term limits a lot. And if you read the voter handbook, you see first that it's going to reduce the total number of years that you can serve from 14 to 12, but now you could serve all those years in one chamber or the other, in the assembly or the Senate. What's your read on that and who that might appeal to and what difference it would make if Prop 28 were to pass?
I think it has mixed appeals. For some people who don't like term limits at all, they're voting no on it because they say this just helps the term limits. For people who really like strict term limits, they're voting no. But for people who think that term limits are okay but are too short right now, they're voting yes. And the interesting thing is that the L.A. Chamber of Commerce and the L.A. Federation of Labor put it on the ballot. They joined together to put it on the ballot. And there's been very little money spent in favor of it. We're seeing money spent against it down here by U.S. term limits. And we're getting phone calls down here, robocalls. We're seeing some TV ads. So I think it's going to be a very close election in terms of Prop 28.
And with the low turnout that's being projected today, as low as 35%, which would be a record for a presidential primary, what does that do, Bob, do you think, to the electorate? Is it likely to be one that's more conservative and perhaps more inclined toward term limits or less inclined toward, say, Prop 29, which would raise taxes?
Usually a low turnout means a more conservative electorate. It also means a more educated electorate, people who are really focusing on these issues. You know, I only had 23 decisions to make this time. That's, for me, it's usually 38 decisions to make. One year I had 100 decisions to make in an election. And, of course, in November we're going to have a lot more decisions. We're going to have at least 13 measures on the ballot. So this was an easy election for most voters. But it also was a non-controversial election since nobody was running against Barack Obama at the presidential level, and Mitt Romney obviously had sewn it up. So for a lot of people in the U.S. Senate race, even though he had 24 candidates running, Dianne Feinstein is probably going to win that easily. So unless you were really interested in your local race or you had some major interest in the tobacco tax, there was not that much reason to get out to vote.
Yeah, talking about that tobacco tax, Prop 29, although it hasn't been the most controversial of ballot measures when you compare it to others in California history. The tobacco industry has spent at least $29 million to try to defeat it. And California is sort of ranks in the middle among states, actually the middle to lower half when it comes to state tobacco taxes. What do you think that says about the power of the tobacco industry?
In 2006, they defeated a tobacco tax, but in 1998 and 1988, they spent over $40 million trying to defeat a tobacco tax increase, and they lost. Again, I think this is going to be a very close election. I think the fact that Lance Armstrong and the Heart, Lung, and Cancer Societies have put in several million dollars to counter the advertising probably stabilized the yes vote to some degree. So I think it's going to be very close. It could go either way.
Corey Cook, we know that in the fall there is going to be several tax measures on the statewide ballot, one from Jerry Brown that would increase sales taxes and income taxes and others. How do you think is there anything in the tea leaves from how Prop 29 turns out that might be instructive, or is November just a whole different ballgame?
Some of each. November is certainly a whole different ballgame in terms of turnout and all of that and how that plays out, I think. You know, these are individual measures. I think what's interesting about the way that 29 has played out is the degree to which this hasn't been really fought about the tobacco tax at all. It's about the commission that's established to spend the money and where the money is spent. And a lot of the campaign commercials have said none of this money goes to education, none of it goes to the general fund, which of course it doesn't and wasn't intended to do. So it's hard to, you know, if that's defeated, it's hard to say then that a tax measure that would go to fund schools, for example, would necessarily fail or pass. But it is interesting to the degree to which I think both 28 and 29 have been both sides have sort of adopted an anti anti-government, anti-incumbent, anti, state government in particular stance in pushing their sides.
Yeah, and in fact, I think one of the selling points for the Prop 29 is that the money wasn't going to go to the legislature.
Exactly right. We can't trust them to spend the money. It doesn't go to the legislature, and then the no side says, but it's creating a whole new bureaucracy. And so it's sort of the competing anti-government messages.
Yeah. I want to go back out into the field now, and there's another hot congressional An interesting congressional race in the 9th District, which includes Stockton, Lodi, and Antioch. You've got an incumbent there, Jerry McNerney, a Democrat, running against Ricky Gill. Our Tara Seiler is in Stockton tonight. And Tara, McNerney has always been a target for Republicans ever since he knocked off Dick Pombo in 2006. Tell us about his challenger this time around, Ricky Gill.
Well, Ricky Gill is, the Republicans see him as a rising star. He has raised a phenomenal amount of money, nearly $1.4 million, and that's more than McNerney, which is really a rare thing to raise more than an incumbent.
What is it about him that's attracted all the money?
He's from this area. He's Indian American. Their Indian American community is really seems to be supporting him and raising a lot of money for him. If you look at his financials, it's a lot of people from the Indian American community, doctors, farmers, businessmen, business people, I should say. And they're here tonight as well.
And is this a district with the redrawn lines that's more favorable to a Democrat or less favorable than the one Jerry McNerney ran in last time?
Well, it's kind of interesting. On paper, it's more favorable. I'd say I think it's 44% are registered Democrats compared to 37% Republican. But the Democrats here are more conservative than his previous district. His last district, was part of, had some Bay Area suburbs. And now it's really much more surrounding Stockton and the San Joaquin Valley, and it's a very agricultural area. And it's also an area that's been really hard hit by unemployment and foreclosure crisis. In fact, as we speak, the Stockton City Council is voting on whether to, is considering bankruptcy for the city and considering whether to give power to the city manager to declare that bankruptcy.
Another thing about Ricky Gill, he's very young. What is he, 25? I think he just graduated from college, from law school.
He's just graduated Bolt Law School. And he went to the Ivy Leagues on the East Coast. And so he's really been in school a very long time and had very little experience on the ground. His family are farmers. They raise grapes, grow grapes. And so he says that he's had a lot of experience working in the family business. But he is 25, and Congressman McNerney is making a lot of that, as is, by the way, there is another GOP candidate, John McDonald, who has only raised $90,000 and it does not seem as viable.
All right. Tara Seiler tonight in Stockton, where she's watching that 9th congressional district. And Tara, I'm sure we'll be hearing from you later in the evening. Thanks so much.
Sure. Pleasure.
Corey Cook, that 9th congressional district here in the sort of Outer Bay area and the Central Valley, do you see that at all as kind of a bellwether in November? In other words, if Ricky Gill knocks off, assuming, and we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit here, but assuming it's Ricky Gill versus McNerney, and the Republicans pick that up, that's got to signal not a good night for the Democrats.
Oh, well, certainly. I think, I'll probably defer to Dan Schnur on this, but it seems to me too that Ricky Gill is sort of the future of the Republican Party in California, and I think that's part of the reason he's attracted so much money is that, if you look at the Republicans, they weren't able to field a credible candidate in the Senate race. There's not much of a Republican bench that a youthful, energetic, connection to the local community, somebody who has business credentials. I think this is sort of who the next generation of Republicans will be.
Dan Schnur, what would you add to that about Ricky Gill? Is Dan still there? Well, he may not be. Rafe Sonnenschein, what about you? What's interesting, one of the things that's interesting is the dearth of Republicans who came forward to run against Dianne Feinstein. It's certainly an indication of her strength, but also the weakness of the bench on the GOP side.
Oh, I mean, it's not even a bench. I mean, I don't know. There's something beyond the bench that you'd have to look at. I'm really struck by what business and labor are doing with the top two in order to get at that. It seems to me labor is going around looking for moderate Republicans to promote. If you go to the Assembly District, the 33rd Assembly District, the Big Bear mayor, and that's the city Big Bear, now he's not a Big Bear, Bill Jung, is a Republican that SEIU is backing. to take on Tim Donnelly. So if you've got a district that is Republican, Labor is coming in and saying, well, you know what, if you're willing to not do these ridiculous pledges, we'll back you up. And meanwhile, what's business doing? Business is helping Rod Wright, a pro-business Democrat in the 35th Senate District in L.A., to avoid a challenge from a Democratic liberal by helping a Republican whose only goal is to get into the runoff so Rod Wright doesn't have to face a liberal Democrat. In other words, business and labor are doing some kind of odd stuff. They're looking for moderates, but not in their own party quite as much, although business is actually looking for moderates in both parties. So even though we all tend to demonize business and labor as the sort of source of polarization in the system, they're actually trying to work at the margins to find some people that are willing to sort of reach agreements. It's kind of interesting.
And Bob Stern, would you say that's a kind of an unintended consequence of the top two, or is that pretty much what was envisioned by people like Arnold Schwarzenegger?
Oh, I think that he was really trying to shake things up, and he really is shaking things up. It'll be probably two or three elections before we really get the full impact. By the way, we should be looking to see how many of these races will result in two Democrats running against each other or two Republicans. The estimate is, and this is just a guess, about 19 of the races will have two Democrats running against each other in November, and about four of the races will have two Republicans. So it's going to affect the Democratic Party far more than it's going to affect the Republican Party.
And Dan Schnur, what would you say, having all those races where you've got two people of the same party running off against each other, what does that mean for a voter who's in that district, not of the party of the two who are in the runoff? I mean, do you think it lessens their interest in turning out?
I think it gives them a voice in the campaign that otherwise wouldn't be there. And this goes back to a conversation we were having earlier in the hour as the real impact, at least in my opinion, of the top two primary. If you live in a district in the Central Valley or in Orange County that's very conservative, and you're a registered Democrat. Under the old rules, there would be a Democrat in the general election who wouldn't have a prayer of winning. Now you live in a district in which there are two Republicans running in the general election, at least one of them, if not both, is going to make some effort to talk to centrist voters from both parties and the independent voters as well. And, of course, the same thing will happen in districts with two Democrats. As we mentioned earlier, we're already seeing longtime Democratic Congressman Howard Berman sending direct mail to Republican voters. And it is a curious spectacle. But on the other hand, it gives a voter in the minority party in a state congressional or legislative district an impact on the race that they wouldn't have had.
And a candidate doesn't want to leave potential votes on the table.
Precisely. And going back to Rafe's point a moment ago, both the business and labor interests around the state understand that these new rules can work to their benefit also. And if you're a business interest in a district that is heavily Democratic, rather than supporting a Republican who simply can't get elected, you support a more business-friendly Democrat. And similarly, if you're organized labor, as Rafe was talking about a moment ago, you look for the more moderate Republican. I think it really does at least have the potential, as voters become more familiar with these new rules, to broaden the conversation in the campaign beyond the ideological cul-de-sacs that represent the bases of both parties to a much wider-ranging conversation, and I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. Dan Schnur from the Jess Unruh Institute of Politics at the University of Southern California. You're listening to special statewide coverage from the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer, and let's continue now with a trip down to San Diego, down in the 52nd Congressional District, which includes La Jolla and San Diego. You've got an incumbent down there, Brian Bilbray, the Republican incumbent, and Allison St. John from KPBS is down there covering that race. And Allison, give us a sense of that race. Does Bilbray have a tough race on his hands, no matter which Democrat emerges in the runoff?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, he obviously knows he's going to be running in November against either Scott Peters, who is the current port chair of San Diego and a former president of the city council, or Lori Saldana, who served some time in the state assembly. And these are two of the strongest Democrats, really, to jump into this race to try to take back the congressional district from the Republicans to the Democrats. At this point, it looks like the stronger candidate might be Scott Peters. He's actually thrown $1.25 million of his own money into the race, I think, to convince fellow Democrats that he's the one who's going to, really commit himself to winning in November. Laurie Saldana, however, is also a very strong candidate, a bit more progressive, narrowly missed getting the state Democratic Party endorsement. So one way or the other, it's going to be a really interesting race in November because, you know, we've had three Republicans, two Democrats in Congress representing San Diego for many, many years. And all eyes are on this district to see if that might change.
And Allison, I want to ask you about a ballot measure that's being considered today in San Diego on pension reform. Give us a quick sense of what that that proposal is on the ballot.
Well, Prop B is a pension reform that would really break the mold of public pensions. It would give all new hires a 401k-style plan instead of a guaranteed pension, which, you know, is a completely different kind of pension. It means that the employee takes the risk if the market goes south. And this has been proposed by Carl DeMaio, who's actually the leading candidate for mayor right now. And interestingly enough, although the supporters of this initiative have raised about $1.5 million to get it through compared to Labor, who have been fighting it tooth and nail, that they only raised $200,000. And I think it looks as though Labor's strategy is to, if it passes, which looks very likely, to fight it in the courts after the fact.
And let me ask you, you alluded to the mayor's race, I know one of the candidates there is Bob Filner, the congressman, Democratic congressman, who must have pretty strong name ID. But you're saying Carl DeMaio, a Republican, is leading in the polls at this point?
At this point, it's pretty much a sure bet. We'd all be shocked if Carl DeMaio doesn't take the lead spot. There are four extremely strong candidates running for mayor of San Diego, one of the most interesting races we've had in a very long time. And as you say, Bob Filner, Democratic congressman, has decided to step down from Congress and throw his hat in the mayoral race. So he has been assuming that he would come in second and be the one that faces off with Carl DeMaio, so you'd have one Republican, one Democrat in November. But at this race, he's got a challenge on his hands from one Nathan Fletcher, who abandoned the Republican Party and went independent and got a huge surge in the polls as a result.
Yeah. And so he's hoping that that he can pick up some of those maybe moderate to conservative Democrats even?
Yes, it's possible that Nathan Fletcher will be stealing votes. It's a little unclear from whether he'd steal more from Carl DeMaio or Bob Filner. But essentially, if Nathan Fletcher gets the second place, that would squeeze Bob Filner out of the November runoff, and San Diego would lose a chance of having a Republican-Democrat race.
Yeah. Of course, it's a nonpartisan race, isn't it, for mayor?
It's a nonpartisan race, that's correct. And the city has had a Republican mayor since the 1990s, early 1990s. It would be a pretty big shakeup if Bob Filner were to win ultimately, and there's a lot of water to pass under the bridge before that would happen.
All right. Allison St. John will begin counting the votes in about 7 minutes. Thanks so much for giving us an update tonight.
My pleasure.
Allison St. John from KPBS down in San Diego. And Corey Cook, we've got a few minutes left here. I want to ask you, what are you going to be looking for tonight in particular? What are some of the really key races? Perhaps we've already mentioned them, but others that we haven't, perhaps, that you think are going to be really interesting to watch?
I'm looking a lot at the state legislative races. I think those are fascinating. I think there are a lot of local dynamics in play at all of those races. But a lot of certainly in the Bay Area, there are a lot of interesting races for the state assembly, for example. There are open seats, so I'm paying attention to that. I think, you know, the elephant in the room, and I hate to suggest we turn our attention to November, you know, 6 minutes.
Oh, there's a presidential election,
right?
There's
a presidential election, and I think, you know, a lot of how this will play out, I think, depends on a vastly different electorate that'll come to vote in November, and how this plays out in terms of turnout. So, you know, you look at a race like the race going on in San Diego. You know, Obama won San Diego in the last election. Now, will he win that in 2012? I think that becomes the important question in terms of how the top two primary plays out. How will, you know, how will turnout be affected in this race? Will Republicans feel the they're unlikely to carry California, but will they have a real campaign here? And might that actually tighten up some of these races? And so I think, you know, to me, it's that trying to extrapolate what happens from these top two primaries, what it tells us about the state of the two political parties in California, but then try to guess what that means in terms of November.
And Dan Schnur, how will we be able to judge the success of the top two and redistricting by November? I mean, or is this something that needs to play out for a few election cycles?
This is going to take some time, and I think your question is very well placed, Scott, because the first step toward making change is changing the rules, but then the players have to learn how to play under those new rules. If you're a basketball coach and I tell you that you're going to get 5 points for a 20-foot shot instead of 3 points, or that your players are going to get 12 fouls rather than five, it's going to take you a little while to figure out how to play the game differently. And we're seeing a relatively small number of declined to stay candidates around the state. Some may be successful, more not in all likelihood. But I think after the 2012 election is over, you're going to see tensions, voices in both parties say, wait a minute, there's an opportunity here, and we haven't quite figured out how to use it yet. My guess is as we get further into the decade, people are going to look back at those rules changes as being much more significant than I think we're seeing right now.
And Rafe Sonnenschein, let me ask you, what are you going to be looking at tonight in particular for, you know, what interests you the most in terms of counting the votes tonight?
Well, I'm really interested in what happens to these independent candidates. I agree with Dan, and I think this is just the camel's nose under the tent or whatever the metaphor is. When people start to figure out that you don't have to stick with your party in order to get elected to Congress or to the Assembly or something like that, or even for statewide office, I think it's going to change how people think about their careers. You'll have people coming out of local offices that are nonpartisan in California and saying, you know what, I don't really have to go through necessarily the party route, but a few people have to win. I really want to see what happens to people who don't take the no tax pledge. I think that's potentially something extraordinarily significant.
And any in particular that you're thinking of?
Not in particular. You know, I'm certainly Mr. Adams is one of them who has snuck out. Abel Maldonado is running, and he was sort of written out of the Republican Party for being a kind of renegade on tax issues.
A rhino.
Yep, a rhino. So all that stuff, you know, no wonder the parties aren't very happy right now. I mean, both parties opposed this top two. I think it changes their world in an unfamiliar way. I think the impact of redistricting, though, we're seeing immediately, because that has thrown incumbents into a state of chaos. But I think that will settle down pretty quickly because some new, you know, people will get elected in those districts, and then those will be districts for a while. The top two, though, you know, for those of you who like to see things shaken up, this is going to be the gift that keeps on giving. And I think this is going to really scramble how people think about politics in California.
And just quickly, Corey Cook, it really makes November that much more interesting, doesn't it?
It does. And I think, as my two colleagues have stated, I think this is the camel's nose. And so it'll be interesting to see how this plays out and how the candidates learn I've drawn back to Dan Schneider's analogy because the first thing you do if they gave you 5 points for a 20-foot shot is that everybody would jack up a bunch of 20-footers. And I think that's sort of what we're seeing right now. and the candidates haven't learned yet. And so you have elections like Dianne Feinstein running against 20 contenders because why the heck not, right?
All right. Corey Cook, Assistant Professor of Politics, Director of the Leo T. McCarthy Center at the University of San Francisco. Thanks so much for being here
tonight.
Thank
you for having me.
Thanks also to Dan Schnur, Rafe Sonnenschein, Bob Stern, Maria Blanco, and our reporters out in the field. The polls are now closing throughout the state. We'll have election results and analysis from the California Report tonight and tomorrow morning on many of these stations. You've been listening to a special election night broadcast from KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. The technical producer is Seal Muller. Our technical staff includes Monte Carlos, Dan Manzer, Steve Pinch, and Larry Wood. Our online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our primary night coverage was produced by Victoria Malione. Tyke Hendricks is our election editor. Ingrid Becker is the senior producer. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995, and the members of KQED Public Radio.